the one thing that they all have in common is that they're protesting inequality.
They try to shut down the encampment. People will defend it. I'm willing to go to jail. There's others that are willing to go to jail over this.
Should we reconsider the policy of keeping officers on full pay, funded by the public, when they are accused of breaching the public trust?
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's campus community radio stations. This week's Groundwire was hosted and produced by CIVL 101.7 FM at the University of the Fraser Valley in Abbotsford, BC. In this edition, we hear from the Indigenous resistance against mining, a Vancouver City bylaw challenged by Falun Gong practitioners, and Scott Gilbert talks about issues of equitable treatment in the story of a Guelph, Ontario police officer charged with drug theft. And now, here are your headlines. A shocking victory for democracy in Abbotsford, British Columbia. With the province holding civic elections, Abbotsford voters went to the polls to decide not only who will be their mayor, city council, and school trustees for the next 3 years, but also, as reported by CIVL 101.7 FM in the May 22nd edition of Groundwire, whether or not to engage in a decades-long P3 private-public partnership project that would see the city of Abbotsford spending upwards of $230 million over the course of the project and receiving upwards of $60 million from the federal government in order to contract a private company to operate a new water system from nearby Stave Lake and Mission. The city of Abbotsford and Mayor George Perry came under fire throughout the election campaign period for a $200,000 information campaign designed to convince Abbotsford voters to say yes to the P3 plan. The Council of Canadians partnered with Water Watch Mission Abbotsford to warn voters against the P3 plan, which would have been the largest such plan in Canada and only the second P3 water project in the country. Despite the expensive information campaign, Abbotsford voters said no by a margin of 3-1, with roughly 30,000 voters turning out and electing a new mayor, Dr. Bruce Banman, though Abbotsford City Council did not experience any significant changes.
A veteran Guelph Police Service officer was arrested and charged Thursday, September 15, 2011, with theft under $5,000 and breach of trust. Constable Chris Panello, a 60-year veteran of the service, was charged after investigation into alleged theft of materials obtained by city police in a drug case. Police Chief Rob Davis ordered an internal investigation in July 2011 into the matter, according to a public statement released by the police service Friday, September 16, 2011. Panello will appear in Guelph Provincial Court next on December 2nd, 2011. Recently, we asked Scott Gilbert, director of Hamilton Medical Marijuana Center, to comment on this news.
The news of charges being brought against a 6-year veteran of the Guelph Police Service is worthy of further investigation by local media. When I read about the arrest, I wondered if it included the same treatment that average drug offenders receive in police custody. The confiscation of one's belt, shoelaces, and eyeglasses so that when they finally stand in front of the judge, their pants are falling down, they're unable to see, and their shoes fall off. Then I wondered if the officer would even have bail terms. But these charges of theft and breach of trust raise deeper questions. In particular, what did the officer intend to do with the stolen drugs? The rational observer derives two possible scenarios: either consume them himself or sell them for profit. But it is questions like this that the Guelph Police Service clearly wants to avoid. Their press release made no mention of what type of drug was stolen. Was it marijuana or crack? What is clear is that the force settled for a slap-on-the-wrist approach for dealing with their own. Full pay, watered-down charges, and the withholding of key details from public scrutiny. I hope local media outlets ask the hard questions. Is it time for officers to submit regular urine samples to monitor for illicit drug use? Should we reconsider the policy of keeping officers on full pay, funded by the public, when they are accused of breaching the public trust? And do the charges that were laid accurately reflect the evidence that is available?
That was Scott Gilbert, director of the Hamilton Medicinal Marijuana Center. I'm Mary Carl Giao in Guelph, Ontario, reporting for Groundwire.
And now it's time for your community radio report. The 2010 National Community and Campus Radio Conference was hosted on Gabriola Island by the Gabriola Radio Society. And though a 30-station collaborative broadcast did take place on 98.7 FM, it was under an Industry Canada Special Event Limited Duration License, according to CKGI.ca. And at the time, Gabriola Radio was still in the midst of an 11-year battle to receive CRTC approval to broadcast on FM radio permanently. As reported during the NCRA's November 14th 14th National Reclaim Your Radio broadcast, the Gabriola Radio Society finally had their CRTC application approved for an English language community radio station on November 2nd, 2011. Starting on January 7th, 2012, Gabriola Radio will hold a year-long fundraising drive. Visit ckgi.ca for more info on how to contribute and show support, or email stnmgr@ckgi.ca or board@ckgi.ca. In Israel, a licensing battle of a different kind has resulted in the shutdown of what the Israeli Communications Ministry is labeling a pirate radio station operating from East Jerusalem. As reported in Haaretz, Kol HaShalom has been broadcasting since 2004 in tribute to the legendary offshore radio station dubbed The Voice of Peace, launched in May 1973 and discontinued in November 1993 after the Oslo Peace Accord appeared to have realized the long-term mission of working towards peace in the Middle East. Kol HaShalom, translated as All for Peace, is a joint initiative between Israeli and Palestinian peace activists authorized by the Palestinian Communications Ministry and operated by former member of the Israeli Knesset, Mossi Raz. Raz received communication on November 4th, ordering a stop to Kol HaShalom's operations, deemed illegal by the Israeli government. The station requested time in order to file a response to the cease and desist order, but Raz was interrogated for 3 hours on Thursday, November 17th, a day after the Communications Ministry received Kol HaShalom's response, and Raz was instructed to discontinue broadcast from Kol HaShalom by decision of the Israeli Communications Ministry and Likud Party Knesset member Danny Danon. According to allforpeace.org, Raz was told he would not be released until he signed a statement stopping broadcasts intended for residents of Israel and was forced to make a phone call ordering the cessation of broadcasting or else face a judge to remand and be arrested. In 2010, Raz and a colleague were recognized for their work with Kol HaShalom, receiving an International Media Award in London, England. The shutdown of Kol HaShalom's broadcast center in Israel, according to the station's website, does not have jurisdiction over the station's broadcast in Ramallah, a Palestinian city on the West Bank, where their tower is located. The station was broadcasting at 107.2 FM in Hebrew and 87.8 in Arabic. Visit allforpeace.org for more information and to show your support.
Last weekend, Media Democracy Day was held in Vancouver. Now in its 11th year, the day was extended to an entire weekend from the 11th to the 13th of November 2011. The event is organized and run by members of the School of Communication at Simon Fraser University, openmedia.ca, as well as countless volunteers, speakers, and exhibitors. This year, over 30 diverse speakers were in attendance. Panel discussions over the weekend included topics such as the future of journalism, crises and opportunities, Indigenous choices, Indigenous voices, Aboriginal uses of media, as well as Shid Harper Did, Slut Walk, and Lead Now, New Directions in Civic Engagement. According to Media Democracy Day's website, the movement runs with three key goals in mind. First, know the media by engaging in critical, progressive, cross-cultural, and intergenerational policy dialogue. Second, be the media by working directly with local media makers to produce messages that intervene in cultural and political life. Third,
Change the Media, by collaborating with community members to create progressive coalitions and actionable political goals. To quote the website, it's about how we govern ourselves, what contributions the media makes to that process, and perhaps most importantly, how we as citizens govern the media.
Yes, I think there is room for optimism, but only if we keep struggling with it, and only if we make sure that we use that social media to really disseminate beyond the quiet. I think the hope is more of hope of organization.
Dr. Sut Jali, a leading academic concerned with democratic media, is a professor of communication at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and founded the Media Education Foundation, MEF, a nonprofit organization that aims to inspire critical reflection on the social, political, and cultural impact of American mass media.
I don't think we on the left have ever been as informed in an immediate way. Democracy Now, I mean, I watch it every single day. But again, the number of people who watch Democracy Now, they already are kind of, they already know. To get to that, you have to know that what you're getting from the mainstream media is already partial.
Jali opened Media Democracy Day on Friday night with a keynote address, followed by a viewing of the film he helped to produce, War Made Easy. The film, narrated by Sean Penn, features archival war footage and a critical commentary from Norman Solomon. War Made Easy shines a light on how the American news media have propagated the pro-war messages of past American presidential administrations. In turn, U.S. public opinion of war has been distorted through media spin, manufacturing support for one war after another throughout American history.
We found the pictures of FDR meeting with the King of Saudi Arabia in 1945. When I showed this film, it's like having an illustrated footnote. No one can argue with you anymore. No one can say this is an interpretation that is not to do with oil, because in fact the visual images actually make that really clear.
To conclude his opening address, Jali urged people to spend as much on independent media as we do on corporate media. For Groundwire, this is Megan Bryan from CIVL 101.7 FM at the University of the Fraser Valley in Abbotsford.
Falun Gong takes city to court for an unconstitutional bylaw. Vancouver Falun Gong practitioners have filed a petition in the Supreme Court of BC asking that a Vancouver City bylaw dealing with protest structures declared unconstitutional and inoperative. At a press conference on November 3rd, Vancouver Falun Dafa Association representative Su Jiang told the media,
"The persecution of Falun Gong remains the number one human rights issue happening in China today. We have reports from United Nations state that the 66% of the torture victim in the labor camp in China today is Falun Gong practitioners. And they state the cruelty and brutality of these alleged acts of torture defy description. So with little influence in society, we did only thing we could do. We went to the street to ask for help."
Falun Gong, also called Falun Dafa, is a spiritual discipline based on truthfulness, compassion, forbearance. Due to the rapid growing popularity, the Chinese Communist Party banned Falun Gong in 1999 and launched a campaign to eradicate it. Since 2001, Vancouver Falun Gong practitioners maintained a 24-hour vigil in front of the Chinese consulate to protest the Chinese Communist Party's alleged genocide against it. The protest site included a small meditation hut on the grass and signs on the consulate fence. In 2006, then-Mayor Sam Sullivan claimed the site violated a city bylaw and sought an injunction to remove it. Falun Gong practitioners appealed. On October 20, 2010, the BC Court of Appeal ruled that a portion of the bylaw was unconstitutional and gave the city 6 months to develop a new bylaw. The draft bylaw caused an uproar when city engineer Peter Judd said the city had held quote-unquote confidential meetings to get some degree of feedback from the consulate on the proposed bylaw. Mayor Gregor Robertson then called for a redraft of the bylaw. In a statement issued on April 14th, the Chinese consulate urged the city to quote, "take effective measures to prevent any activities from Falun Gong and protect the safety, peace, and dignity of the Chinese Consulate General," unquote. Although the statement denied accusation that the consulate officials had put pressure on the city, a An affidavit provided to the court in 2007 by Mr. Chen Yonglin revealed that the constant protests in Vancouver was a, quote, major embarrassment to the Chinese government, unquote. Chen Yonglin was a former first secretary for the Chinese consulate in Sydney who defected from the Chinese Communist Party in 2005. The new version of the bylaw was passed in April this year. Ms. Su Jiang said,
the current restriction of this new revised bylaw has thoroughly disabled our freedom of expression, fundamentally rendered our protest outside the Chinese consulate ineffective.
In addition to the restriction of the size of structures, protest permits would only be valid for a maximum of 30 days and would need to be applied for every other month. Any structures must be removed between 8 p.m. and 8 a.m. David Ebby, director of the BC Liberties Association, said at the conference, the restriction is an attempt by the city to impede free political expression. The BC Liberty Association will be bringing or joining a court case against it. Falun Gong lawyer Clive Ansley believes that the bylaw aimed at preventing Falun Gong's protest. He said,
the reason why we have to go back to court today really boils down to the fact that since the administration of Sam Sullivan in 2006, City Council in Vancouver has been prepared to put the interests and the comfort of a foreign government well ahead of the interests of Canadian citizens in free speech and civil liberty.
Just one day after the tragic death of Ashley, a resident of Occupy Vancouver, and just hours after Mayor Robertson called for the end of the camp, the mood at the Vancouver Art Gallery was mournful, yet defiant.
If they try to shut down the encampment, people will defend it. I'm willing to go to jail. There's others that are willing to go to jail over this. And the reality of the situation is, you know, Jim Chu said this in City Hall last week, that every time they do try to take down an encampment, the numbers just grow. So, you know, if they shut this down, we'll move it to City Hall. We'll move it to 58 West Hastings. We'll move it to Little Mountain Social Housing Development. You know, they can take down these tents, but they're not going to take down our movement.
That defiant energy carried on through the day as hundreds of protesters joined with indigenous people to oppose destructive mining practices on their territories.
The plans of Christy Clark and the BC government to push mining and pipeline developments to unceded indigenous territories will fail.
The second Indigenous Assembly Against Mining and Pipelines called for a rally to coincide with a pro-mining conference organized by the Canadian Aboriginal Mining Association.
There's a mining conference happening right now here in Vancouver that's sponsored by mining companies, and they're trying to bring Indigenous people together to sell the idea of opening up mines within their territory, since they know they do need certainty over the land, and they're trying to push non-treaty agreements with these Native bands, but what we're saying is that these Native bands have no right to sell our land. They have no right to make mining agreements with these companies. So that's what we're here to address as well.
Indigenous communities from all over the world joined the large crowd to wake up the people to the destructive reality of Canadian mining.
My name is Charo. I am from San Luis Potosí, which is an area, a sacred protected area in the desert called Wirikuta, which is indigenous heritage land. So Goldcorp and First Majestic have got a hold of 38 open pit mining concessions that will completely destroy all the land.
In the central coast of BC, proposed fossil fuel pipelines and an expansion of shipping infrastructure threatens a unique ecosystem known as the Great Bear Rainforest. Dustin Johnson explains how people in Vancouver can help the growing resistance against these developments.
Raise awareness and to attack people in the city and show what's going on in the city where the corporate headquarters are. All these investments are being made in the concentrated headquarters of downtown Vancouver, downtown Toronto, downtown Calgary. Just to raise awareness and show solidarity with people, true solidarity. We're not trying to appropriate Native people's voices, but respecting them to take the lead in their own territories.
As the march reached Canada Place, the protesters were greeted by a large line of police and a few folks who were taking part in the conference.
We're trying to secure our resources. We're trying to make it better for our people. And one way to do that is resource development.
But the presence of law enforcement did not dampen the defiant mood of the group. The fighting spirit of the many indigenous folks at the action re-inspired the people of Occupy Vancouver, who were reminded of the importance to defend the land.
And now, a feature from Contact, the interview program heard on Voiceprint, a service of Accessible Media Incorporated. I'm Yasmin Benin. What is a promise to tell the truth? How should the Canada Evidence Act be properly interpreted to allow witnesses who are unable to understand an oath or affirmation to communicate evidence? Those questions are at the heart of a case currently being heard by the Supreme Court of Canada. The case involves an intellectually disabled woman referred to as KB, who reported to a teacher that her stepfather had, in her words, played games with her that involved touching her genitals and breasts. At trial, her competence was successfully challenged when she could not give a definition of the word truth. The stepfather was acquitted. The appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada argues that people with developmental disabilities are being discriminated against when it comes to giving testimony under the Canada Evidence Act. Both the Women's Legal Education and Action Fund, or LEAF, and the Disabled Women's Network Canada, or Don RAF Canada, have stepped forward as interveners in this particular case. Joanna Bierenbaum is Director of Litigation for LEAF. She says that while children are not asked to explain what truth is when giving testimony, people with developmental disabilities are still subjected to this line of questioning.
We have expressed the significant concern that treating persons with mental disabilities as the only category of witness that is asked these questions is rooted in deep stereotypes, discriminatory stereotypes of persons with mental disabilities as being inherently unreliable, and that they can't be believed, and that they're treated as less valuable and less worthy. We pointed out to the court, someone who's a convicted perjurer who has lied on the stand in the past can get up in court on another occasion and will not be asked questions about, well, do you really mean it when you say that you're affirming or that you're swearing to tell the truth before they give evidence. So that line of questioning not asked of convicted perjurers. From probably when they finally do give evidence, they'll be asked questions about their truthfulness of their statements, but they're not excluded at the outset in the way that persons with mental disabilities are.
Some 83% of women with intellectual disabilities will be sexually abused in their lifetime, according to Don RAF Canada. Of these, 70% of the abuses may occur before the age of 18. And fewer than 25% of cases are confined to one incident. Carmela Hutchison, president of Don RAF Canada, says dependency is a major factor for women with developmental disabilities being potential victims of assault.
In the case of women with disabilities overall, it's by virtue of the fact that they are disabled and there's a higher degree of dependency on others, and a higher degree of, you know, people sort of having a level of control over their lives if they were disabled from childhood that they would not have otherwise had.
The Supreme Court of Canada is expected to bring down a decision sometime next spring. Both interviews can be heard in their entirety at AMI.ca. Look under the VoiceBrint page and search for the interview program Contact. For Accessible Media, I'm Yasmin Benin, reporting to Groundwire.
The Occupy Movement. If you want a discussion to get heated as quickly as possible, the phrase Occupy, followed by the closest major city to you, will generate enough debate to strain even the closest of relations. Depending on who you ask, the Occupy protesters are the sign of a middle class finally waking up to the past 30 years of losing ground to the wealthy and corporations, a bunch of self-entitled students who want everything handed to them without having to work a day in their lives, or nothing but a bunch of hippies who should be disregarded accordingly. At any rate, Civil Radio's Lohan Nguyen was intrigued. What was it that brought these people to camp out on the lawn of the Vancouver Art Gallery? Thus, she took a recorder down to the site of the scene itself to ask a few questions.
This movement isn't necessarily about any one thing. I would say the one thing that they all have in common is that they're protesting inequality as a general theme. And the inequality in the States is really tied to money and politics. We don't have quite that problem with money and politics here, so our direction is going to be slightly different.
Not about any one thing. Surely you can't have a protest without everyone being on the same page. Surely these occupiers must be occupying for some reason. Not long after the conversation had begun, the man offered to Lohan his own reasons for being among the tents.
But I mainly realized and have been wanting to have a sort of discussion out in the open with the population. I want people to start talking again. I want people that disagree on issues to be able to respect each other and dialogue and it go somewhere. And when you're talking, when you're like commenting on Facebook, when you're reading comments on news stories, when you read articles and stuff, or you're just sitting with your friends that you always agree with, I mean, you're not really, it's just polarizing. People can't actually ever talk about something.
Talk about something. You don't say. It does often seem that we care less about the issues in politics and more concerned with winning an argument. Those at Occupy Vancouver, however, are vocalizing their opinions in a peaceful manner. For Groundwire, this is Chris Hunter reporting from 101.7 CIVL-FM in Abbotsford.
And now for your national upcoming events listing. This year, Black Friday, often the biggest shopping day in the U.S. and the kickoff to the Christmas shopping season, falls on November 25th. Major retailers love this day. It can conceivably make or break a Christmas season for them, which of course makes it the perfect day to have a Buy Nothing Day. Visit buynothingday.org, adbusters.org/campaigns/BND, or search Buy Nothing Day on Facebook for events and initiatives near you. For information and a directory of Occupy movements across the country, visit occupytogether.org and find out how you can occupy the holidays. That does it for this edition of Groundwire, brought to you by CIVL 101.7 FM at the University of the Fraser Valley's Abbotsford campus on traditional Stolo territory in Abbotsford, British Columbia. Music was by Obijou and Blondwich. Thank you goes out to all of our contributors and all of the people who make campus community radio possible. You can listen to Groundwire on your local campus and community radio station or online at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is brought to you by the National Community and Campus Radio Association. Thank you for listening.